I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome back to Radio Times. The U.S. Supreme Court issued a ruling on Monday about threats and social media. The case involved a Pennsylvania man, Anthony Alonis, who had posted violent and threatening messages on his Facebook page about his estranged wife, an FBI agent who came to his house, and some local schools. He was sentenced to 44 months in prison after the jury was told the standard was whether a reasonable person believed his words were a true threat. In a 7-2 decision, the Supreme Court said what mattered was a higher standard, what Alonis intended by his words, his state of mind when he posted his rants. I'll talk with Dahlia Lithwick, who wrote about this case for Slate, in just a few minutes. But first, our guest is one of Anthony Alonis's lawyers. Abraham Ryan is associate in the Internal Investigations and White Collar Defense Group at the Philadelphia law firm of Post and Shell. And Abe Ryan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It's great to be on.
What's your client's response to this ruling on Monday?
Well, we and our client are very pleased, obviously. I'm an advocate for him, and he are very happy with what the Supreme Court did. One of the key things for him is there's an actual sentence in this opinion that says, and this is a quote, this conviction cannot stand. So we're pleased about that. I'd say that this is bigger than Mr. Alonis, too. This is an opinion that's going to have an effect on criminal statutes generally, and particularly on crimes involving speech. So this is a big thing.
Indeed, it is a big thing, which is certainly one of the reasons why we're talking about it on Radio Times today. When the court says this cannot stand, does that mean he and you go back to court to, address the initial judgment?
Well, that's a good question, Marty. So what happens next is what the Supreme Court has done is it said the conviction cannot stand. You, Third Circuit, which is the court of appeals that decided the case before it went to the Supreme Court, you guys figure out what to do with it next. So it sends it back down to the Third Circuit. And, we don't know. I can't say what the Third Circuit will do. But given that language in the opinion, this conviction cannot stand, it seems likely to me that what the Third Circuit will say is, the conviction is vacated and send it back down to the trial court to decide what to do.
Does Anthony Alonis in any way regret what he said? And I'll just quote one of the things that he said. This was actually October 2010. It was shortly after his wife, they'd been married for 7 years. She moved out of their house, I think took their two children with them. And he posted this on his Facebook page. If I only knew what I know now, I would have smothered your ass with a pillow, dumped your body in the back seat, dropped you off in Toad Creek, and made it look like a rape and murder. Now, the court says that this was not a true threat. But does he regret some of the rants that he posted on his Facebook page?
Well, to be clear, the Supreme Court didn't decide, and this is sort of one of these lawyerly nuances, but it kind of probably matters. The Supreme Court didn't decide whether or not any of the language at issue in the case was a true threat. And I think actually that particular posting was never even, it wasn't part of his indictment. But the Supreme Court only said, the Supreme Court didn't say whether that was a true threat or not. It said that before we send somebody to jail, like Mr. Alonis, for words that they uttered, a jury needs to consider what was going on in that person's mind and whether he actually intended to threaten somebody or not. And in this case, a jury didn't. That just didn't happen. The jury was specifically instructed not to consider that.
Right.
So that's what the importance of the Supreme Court opinion is.
What the jury decided, and I guess what they were instructed, was that it was this kind of what a reasonable person would think those kinds of words meant.
Correct. Exactly. The jury was instructed to come up with a hypothetical reasonable person that they could imagine and say, would this reasonable person think that those words would be taken as a threat? Not did Mr. Alonis think that they would.
So how in a court of law then, and of course this is something that happened a number of years ago, but how does a court determine a person's intent?
Yeah, that is a great question.
I mean, how do you determine what's going on in their head at that time?
Right. That's a good question, and it's one that gets asked a lot in connection with this case. And, part of the answer to that is the majority of criminal statutes include an intent element. And in fact, that's part of what this Supreme Court opinion turns on. We as a society are not comfortable putting people in jail, convicting them of crimes without considering whether they actually, you know, what did you mean to do it? So the majority of criminal of crimes include an intent element. And so juries actually make these intent determinations every single day, and prosecutors put on evidence of intent every single day. And, you know, what does that evidence consist of? It can be a lot of different things. It's, you know, generally circumstantial. I mean, you can, if the defendant testifies, you can ask him. That's one thing. But there is generally circumstantial evidence. What did his friends say? What did he, what was he aware of, which you can prove based on, you know, emails that he got or texts that he had about how people were reacting to what he said, et cetera. And the jury can even be asked to just use its common sense. Ladies and gentlemen, do you really think he didn't mean to do this?
Does a court take into consideration how his wife felt about those words? My understanding is at one point she got a protection. In fact, she did get a protection from abuse order. Is that also how intent is determined?
Well, so I think the answer to your question is not really. I mean, or it's more of a yes and no, I think. How did his wife react? Of course it matters. You know, it's an important thing to have. You know, it's part of the fact pattern. And his wife is a person, and her reaction, I think, is evidence of how a reasonable person would react. So if you're using a reasonable person standard, it matters in that sense, too.
Let me quote something that a solicitor general, this is Donald Varelli, said, basically saying about your client. He was aware of the meaning and context of his Facebook posts, and those posts communicated a serious expression of an intent to do harm. Obviously, the court disagreed with him. I assume you do as well.
Again, just to be totally clear, I don't think that the court really decided that whether or not he was right. Mr. Varelli, when he said that Mr. Alonis was aware of the content of his post, I guess the court did agree, or there was evidence that he was aware of the actual words he was posting. Whether or not the post contained a serious expression of an intent to commit harm, I mean, that's the question. That's the question that we have. That's what this case is about. How do we decide what is a serious expression of an intent to commit harm? I mean, a serious expression, that word serious probably denotes some sort of intent.
Now, he described himself as a rapper, in fact, had a name for himself, Tone Doogie. And my understanding was that part of your argument, or I guess the argument for his lawyer, was that he had kind of First Amendment rights, sort of like Eminem and some of these rappers that, you know, say things that sound kind of offensive, that was part of his defense. But it sounds like the court didn't go for the First Amendment argument.
Yeah, that's right. That's one of the really, I mean, as a lawyer who just kind of gets excited about legal principles, that's one of the really interesting things about this opinion. We put a lot of emphasis on this First Amendment argument, and it got a lot of attention, I think. And the court basically said, you know what, we're going to leave for another day what the First Amendment requires. But as we read this statute, we think just the statute itself requires the jury to consider what Mr. Alonis' state of mind was.
So how should just sort of regular people then understand how this opinion might apply to them? And I realize it's legally complex.
Yeah, but no, it's here it is. And forgive me if I'm repeating myself, but I think this is really key. Here is the plain meaning of this opinion. You can't be put in jail for saying something in any medium, you know, speaking it with your mouth or writing it on the internet or any other medium that someone else decides was threatening, unless you actually had a state of mind that in which you intended it to be threatening, or you at least knew that someone would take it as a threat. So it actually gives, and you know, this is important in the social media age because, and I could go on and on about this, but
sure.
The way social media works, there is such a potential for a disconnect between what the speaker is thinking, what they mean and how they think their words are going to be taken, and what the audience, which could be the entire world, people that don't know the speaker at all, know nothing about his or her sense of humor or state of mind, what they take it to mean.
I mean, are you saying that intent on social media takes on a different kind of meaning?
First of all, this case is interesting because it has a social media angle to it, because the speech at issue happened on Facebook. Importantly, sort of from a legal perspective, the court's analysis had nothing to do with the fact that it happened on Facebook. The court's analysis applies no matter how the speech was communicated. But I think that speech that's conveyed via social media is much more likely to be interpreted in a way that's different from what the speaker intended it to be interpreted.
Just because things, as you say, kind of can often do take on a life of their own and get passed on from one person to the other, farther and farther, I guess, away from the person who wrote the original post.
Yes, exactly, exactly. So, if I'm putting a post on Facebook, I am probably thinking that the people who are going to read it are my Facebook friends. And if I'm tweeting on Twitter, I'm probably thinking that the people who are going to read my tweet are my Twitter followers. And those tend to be people who know me and who know my sense of humor and have the same sort of mindset that I do. But depending on the privacy settings and how you have your account configured, what you post on social media is actually can be available to the entire world, anybody, anywhere. And in fact, it will be available forever, because you can't actually effectively retract it. You can't delete it. So it's very likely that somebody who doesn't know, there is a great chance that somebody who doesn't know me, doesn't understand where I'm coming from, will see the things that I post, and they could well interpret it differently. If I could, there's another reason why the fact that it happens on the internet matters. The internet has its own culture and its own language that people that aren't part of it don't necessarily understand. And very briefly, here's a story that comes out of the Alonis case.
Very briefly, yeah, we're almost out of time, but go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Alonis, in one of his posts, at the end of his post, he put a colon followed by a capital P, which to a lot of us, if you see it written down, it looks a little bit like a face sticking its tongue out. And people on the internet understand that to mean I'm joking. But the FBI agent who investigated Mr. Alonis testified on the stand that she did not know what that symbol meant. Hmm. So she didn't understand a lot or pieces of what he said.
Well, we could go on, but we have to say goodbye to you. And I thank you for getting us started in this rather complicated but very important conversation. A. Brian, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's associate in the Internal Investigations and White Collar Defense Group at the Philadelphia law firm of Post and Shell, one of the lawyers who represented a man named Anthony Alonis, a Pennsylvania man named Anthony Alonis. And the court of the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on his conviction earlier this week. Stay with us. We do have Dahlia Lithwick waiting in the wings. We will carry on our conversation. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. So is a threat on Facebook a crime? According to the U.S. Supreme Court, not unless the person posting the message intended actual harm. Earlier this week on Monday, the court overturned the conviction of a Pennsylvania man, a man named Anthony Alonis, who was convicted and sent to prison for putting threatening messages on Facebook about his estranged wife, about an FBI agent, and some local school students. Alonis's attorneys, and we just spoke to one of them, argued that his posts were not true threats but therapeutic rants. Alonis said he was just rapping. Joining us now is Dahlia Lithwick. She writes about the courts and the law for Slate. I should add she served on the board of the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Speech, which was one of Alonis's lawyers. And Dahlia, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hi there, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Okay, now I am entirely confused. Tell me, what was the Supreme Court ruling on Monday? I thought I understood it, but having talked to Abraham Ryan, I'm not sure, so sure that I do.
No, I think you do. I think it's just complicated because we expected a blockbuster First Amendment ruling, and we didn't get that. And so I think everybody's sort of like, well, wait, what did we get? We got a really almost trivial ruling about how to read the intent requirement in a criminal threat statute. And so this just turned into a very narrow statutory case, and it basically only applies to this one statute that criminalizes making interstate threats, but it doesn't help us understand any of the big questions you're trying to ask, which is rap protected music? Are threats protected music? How does the internet change? We don't know answers to any of that. And so I think it's not that we don't understand the case, it's that the case answered, the court answered this in such a minimalist fashion that the case almost stands for nothing. In fact, I think as you heard Mr. Ryan say, we don't even exactly know whether Alonis goes back to trial, and even if he does, we don't even know what the standard is by which he'll be tried. So I think the easiest way to think about this is the lead up to this case was that the court was going to wade into these big, big existential questions about First Amendment protections for internet speech, and it didn't do that.
Yeah. Well, let me quote something that from Justice Clarence Thomas, who dissented on this. He said, "Our job is to decide questions, not create them. Given the majority's ostensible concern for protecting innocent actors, one would have expected it to announce a clear rule, any clear rule. Its failure to do so reveals the fractured foundation upon which today's decision rests." Do you agree with Justice Thomas?
You know, reluctantly, in this case, I really do. I think that the court has some responsibility to be clear. And when they announce a decision, they need to say, okay, the test that was used, this test that said the only thing that matters was how the listener, the reasonable listener, interprets the threat, they junked that test, but they didn't say what the new test is. And very, very specifically, and this is a little bit in the weeds, but very specifically, what Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, who dissented in part, said was, at least tell us if the standard is negligence or recklessness. In other words, if you're going to say all we're going to do is interpret the mental state requirement, tell us what the mental state is. And the majority didn't do it. And I think this goes to a really interesting problem with the Roberts Court, which is sometimes in the effort to get unanimity, to get 7-2, 8-1 rulings, they decide so little that they in fact decide nothing at all.
Well, let me read a couple of more of these quotes. And again, you know, this gets to this sort of reasonable person standard or whether there's a true threat intended. I read one of them. There's another one where he says there's one. This is to his wife, I guess, or he's posting about his wife. There's one way to love you, but 1,000 ways to kill you. I'm not going to rest until your body is a mess, soaked in blood and dying from all the little cuts. At one point, he says, fold up your protection from abuse order and put it in your pocket. Is it thick enough to stop a bullet? Now, using the sort of reasonable person standard, or maybe even using Mrs. Alonis's standard, those feel like threats to me.
Sure they do. And Mrs. Alonis testified at his trial. She said, I was terrified. I read that, and I thought I was in danger and my children was in danger. And the juror said, heck, we would have been terrified too. The important thing to understand is that the jurors were instructed, it doesn't matter at all what Anthony Alonis intended to do, what he thought, what he believed he was doing. The only thing that mattered is what a reasonable listener would have thought. That's the part that the court couldn't live with. What the court said was that what he was thinking had to matter. It has to matter because in criminal law, always, as Mr. Ryan said, always we look at this mens rea question, this mental state question. And so I think where the court balked was the court is willing to stipulate that what he did would have been terrifying to a listener. But is that enough to convict someone for 3 years, to send them to prison for 3 years, without any scrutiny of whether he intended it? And the court says, you know what, all of criminal law relies on finding out that the perpetrator wanted to do what he did, knew what he was doing, at the very least was negligent or reckless. And that's what the court couldn't tolerate. I will say just one other note. I think that even if this case goes back to the trial court and he gets retried under a higher standard, as the court now requires, because of exactly what your reaction was and the juror's reaction and the fact that a lot of people think, oh, my God, he clearly intended to scare her, even under a test where we look at what he wanted to do, he may fail because it really does look like what he was trying to do was terrorize her.
Well, and talking to his lawyer, he was talking about the internet, sort of language on the internet takes on a life of its own. Should we think, Dahlia, about what we say in public is under sort of one set of laws? Like if I say some of these things to you on the street or I post them on my Facebook page, is there different criteria to determine something like threat?
Well, you know, that's why this case held so much promise for people who thought that the court was going to wade bravely into the world of online communications and make a statement about that. I mean, the last time the court has looked at these true threats question, this, you know, has been decades, and this had to do with face-to-face conduct, where you really can, I think, do a better job of figuring out, wait, that guy really is threatening me. I can see his eyes. I can see his words. And so I think that this whole issue of whether a threat is a threat in cyberspace is something that the court, because they ducked the First Amendment question, they were probably as scared as anyone of getting out ahead of, you know, the popular discourse. And I think the court, in part, ducked these big questions about, is a threat the same in cyberspace as it is out on the street? Because it's a big, big deal to go there for the first time.
Well, let me ask you, Dahlia, about the First Amendment part of this. As you say, the court really didn't rule on that, although his attorneys were, I think, arguing that. If it's a First Amendment issue, and I think, you know, he imagined himself as a rapper, he had a name for himself. Does that put this language into a protected category?
Well, I guess we won't know for a while because
I'm asking you, Chief Justice Dahlia Lithwick, just so you know.
This case, and you can probably tell I've taken a lot of heat this week, Marty, for writing on both sides of this case.
Yeah.
This is one that is very hard. And as you say, I serve on a board that wrote an amicus brief supporting Alonis. I think that this is another one of those cases, and we've talked about them before. You know, this is the Westboro Baptist Church. Mm-hmm. This is violent video games. These are all these First Amendment cases just smoke out the most hideous, awful human beings and the worst, vilest form of speech. And so they're always hard cases because at one level, of course, this should be protected speech. This is rap music. What he was doing was completely and admittedly derivative of Eminem, right? He said, I'm just a rapper and I am exactly the way Eminem fantasized elaborately about destroying and dismembering his own wife.
That's right.
This is what Anthony Alonis says he's doing. How is this different? And so there's a way in which, of course, it looks like it should be protected speech. This is art. This is music. But then in a, you know, deeper way, and I think this is what you're reacting to, he's terrifying his own wife, and he's putting it up on Facebook, and she's afraid for the lives of their children. And so I think in all the ways that these First Amendment cases are so very hard, it has so much to do with context. It has so much to do with these valences of violence against women, you know, online threats against women. You can't take that out of this equation, the way women experience harassment and threats online. So all of that is going on. And to say, well, it's clearly pure speech because he's an artist seems a little bit too facile.
And that's Dahlia Lithwick. We're talking about this case that the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on Monday involving a Pennsylvania man, basically saying that his very violent and threatening Facebook posts were not a true threat to the intended targets, one of them being his estranged wife, also an FBI agent that came to his door, and also school children, I guess, because one of his rants or one of his posts had to do with the potential of shooting up a school. Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and the law for Slate, and we'd love to hear from you as we wrestle through this particular ruling, this particular case. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio. Radio Times and give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Dahlia, let me read an email from Beverly. She says, this decision is wrong. Now women are even more in danger from domestic violence. How could anyone not think that what Anthony Alonis wrote on Facebook was not a threat? How can he write that he wanted to take his wife into the woods and rape and kill her, or that I'm not going to rest until your body is a mess, soaked in blood and dying from the little cuts, and not intend to hurt her? And of course, this is what we're struggling with.
It is, and I should say that this email gives voice to not just a lot of women's groups and violence against women's groups who strongly supported the idea that we don't care what the perpetrator is thinking. What we care is that women live in terror every day because of language like this. And it just became a little easier to post language like that. And this was when Don Verrilli, you know, you read his statements earlier, the U.S. Solicitor General, argued this case at the court. He really gave voice to this sentiment, too. We don't care what people who are posting these threats or these not threats, these artistic rap lyrics, think. What we care is that fear itself is the real crime here, and to put these women in perpetual fear for their lives is what we're trying to eradicate. And I think that that is a strong argument. I think the flip of that argument, as we've been saying, is what do we do with a guy like Anthony Alonis, who says he's an artist, who is at pains to say in many of his posts, hey, I'm just testing the First Amendment limits. Mm. You know, look at me. I'm making a First Amendment point. This is First Amendment performance art. And also, and I think this is of some value to smoke out too, he says this is therapeutic, right? He says, my wife took my kids. She left me. I was desolate. I was working out my issues in what I thought was a safe way.
I should add, though, I mean, as you mentioned, you initially came down on the side of Alonis, yes?
I think my first piece when I previewed this case over a year ago, I think I came down on the side of the government that we needed to have be really vigilant about online violence. I think I have since then come to be, not that I defend him, and for the same reasons I can't defend the Westboro Baptist Church, but because I think there are free speech principles here, and there's a slippery slope here, Marty, that says that if anybody who posts rap lyrics, and we should be really careful and say there are a lot of people in jail in America right now for posting rap lyrics, because when you're a disenfranchised minority community, things that you think are art can be really scary. And there are folks who've gone to jail because their lyrics are used against them, either as evidence of complicity in a crime or that they're inciting other crimes. I mean, this is not a joke that there are people who have done nothing more than put up rap, which is by definition really gruesome and violent. And one of the amicus briefs in this case on the side of Alonis wasn't defending him, but was trying to say to the court, you don't understand what this art form means. This is an art form that is born out of terrific suffering and poverty. It has to be violent in order to have, you know, real punch, and that you can't put people in jail just because this is an opera.
Do we, though, as citizens, do we have a right not to be threatened, or we just have to learn how to deal with it? I'm thinking of Westboro Baptist Church, you know, the sort of horrific things they do at funerals. But I know that, you know, there are ways of almost putting a wall of people, you know, between the people from Westboro Baptist Church and the people that are mourning someone's death. I mean, is there a way to protect people from feeling harassed or threatened?
That's the question, and it's the right question. And it, you know, when the court looked at the Westboro Baptist Church a couple of years ago, you may recall they had a similarly frustrating decision for people. You know, it was, again, Samuel Alito. You know, the dissenters are always the same dissenters who say, whatever happened to civil discourse? Whatever happened to saying there's some things you can't do at a military funeral? But this is an overwhelmingly speech-protective court, and what this court tends to say in those cases is, look, speech is speech, and you might not like it. But, you know, in military funeral context, we have time, place, and manner restrictions, right? You can put up buffer zones. You can put up areas in which the protesters can't go. But no, you don't, as a military family, have a right to completely avoid hearing speech, even the most odious speech, because in this court's view, and again, this is really unique to the Roberts Court, speech is speech, and we can't start slicing and dicing speech that we don't like just because we don't like it.
Let me ask you about a case. This goes back to 2003. It's Virginia v. Black. This was a Virginia statute that was declared unconstitutional. The statute made it a crime to threaten someone with a KKK cross burning, and that court said that was unconstitutional.
Right, and that was an amazing case because that was Clarence Thomas, who is famously really reticent, right? He hasn't spoken on the bench in years, and he gave powerful voice in that case to the idea that a cross burning isn't just speech, that it is a threat and that it is perceived as exactly that. And that is, in fact, the last time the U.S. Mm-hmm. Supreme Court looked at this doctrine of two true threats. I mean, this is, it's hard to explain what an outlier in First Amendment law, this idea of true threats is. It comes up every couple of decades, we get a true threats case. But I think that generally the court's posture on this is, okay, we're not going to protect certain kinds of speech. You know, we're not going to protect obscenity, and we're not going to protect fighting words, right? That's shouting, falsely shouting fire in a crowded theater. We're not going to protect true threats. But the court has never really probed what true threats are. And this case, again, gave the court an opportunity since that cross-burning case to say, okay, we're really going to nail down what a true threat is. And you know, as we've been saying, they simply ducked it. There was no First Amendment rule to emerge from this case.
Let's take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. A lot of people want to join the conversation, Dahlia. Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and the law for Slate. And we've been talking about this Alonis case that was decided by the court on Monday. We began our conversation talking with Anthony Alonis, as one of his attorneys here in Philadelphia. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499 as we wrestle through this decision. You can send us an email, as folks are doing, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Dahlia Lithwick from Slate about social media, Facebook threats, a decision made earlier this week by the U.S. Supreme Court. Dahlia, let me read a tweet from Christopher. He says, does this mean I can write the exact same words as Anthony Alonis but direct them at George Bush or Dick Cheney without fear of prosecution?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, there are very, very strict rules about threatening and again, meaningfully threatening, you know, the president or your members of Congress. You know, every time anyone does something like that, they get investigated. Now, again, they have to have, there has to be an intent requirement. You know, one of the first cases about a true threat was somebody who was making a ridiculous hyperbolic threat about killing the president. And the court said, you know what, that's not a real threat. Everyone knew that was hyperbole. Wow. And so, again, I think in these cases, you know, context is always going to matter. But certainly, I think, you know, there are different statutes. Again, this is not the statute under which Alonis was convicted, but there are certainly statutes that theoretically impinge on your free speech right to threaten the life of the president. But I think that these same issues of what did you intend to do? What was the context? Was this hyperbole that go into determining whether there's a conviction there?
Let me see what Suma from Princeton has to say. And Suma, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. It is an interesting decision. It's very ambiguous. But it also poses a very serious problem for law enforcement, in my point of view, that somebody can be explicitly making a threat on social media against a potential victim. But it makes this decision makes it possible for that person to give that statement any interpretation that they feel like giving to it, and it's a very serious problem. very gentleman has never been a rapper before, so you could not argue that he was a rapper in the past for him to use that to be rapping. And the statement he made has very strong connection to the people that he was referring to.
Well, Suma, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And does this raise questions for law enforcement? And I should add to that, Dahlia, which is that an FBI agent went to Alonis' door. This was after he made this threat. And I'll just read it here. Enough elementary schools in a 10-mile radius to initiate the most heinous school shooting ever imagined. And hell hath no fury like a crazy man in a kindergarten class. The only question is which one. FBI agent goes to his house, and then he posts on his Facebook after she leaves, little agent lady stood so close, took all my strength I had not to turn the bitch ghost, pull my knife, flick my wrist, and slit her throat.
Yeah, that's a winner.
I was going to say, I mean, this is what the court was dealing with, but I think as, you know, as regular people, it's also what we have to deal with.
Right. And that was, I mean, that threat against the FBI agent was one of the counts on which he was convicted. In other words, that was something where, again, the jury said a reasonable listener would perceive that exactly the way you just did, which is that's a threat against her. And again, I would just stipulate, I think, that even if he goes back to trial under a higher mental state standard, that still conviction may still stand because it looks like he intended to threaten her. But to Suma's point, I mean, I think it's absolutely true that law enforcement is very disappointed in this result. There are women's groups, women's rights groups, who say that the internet is, quote, the crime scene of the 21st century, and that most domestic violence and domestic harassment and horrible domestic killings originate, the statistic I read this week was that 90% originate with online or Twitter or Facebook threats. So this is kind of the gateway drug to start harassing your ex-wife or your ex-girlfriend, and for the police not to be able to treat this as though it's as serious as showing up at your wife's house with a knife really impedes their ability to solve crime. So I don't for one minute want to say that the police are happy about this. I think that the reason Don Verrilli and the Justice Department took such a strong stand in this case for the reasonable listener standard is because they really feel that the police need to be able to treat these kinds of threats as threats and not as, you know, performance art and not as therapy.
Suma, thanks for the call. Let me get Sharon from Upper Darby to join the conversation. Hi, Sharon. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi. My understanding of the First Amendment, that the First Amendment stops when harm begins. Like, you're not supposed to cry fire in a crowded theater.
Mm-hmm.
Well, apply that to domestic violence and the PTSD that I now experience when I am screamed at on the street because I'm slowing down for by a male. I'm screamed at, cursed at by a driver because I'm slowing down for a school guard. But what really I find very disturbing is that when it's if it was applied to women and the suffering we experience, now I still am traumatized. I am harmed by the things that have been said to me. I'm going to kill you. All kinds of horrible things. And but when a noose is hung at a university, there's absolute outrage, and nobody talks about the First Amendment. And why are women different in this country? Why are females of every ethnicity? Why is it that men can say and do anything, and yet and I agree with the noose thing, 100 years of lynching, okay? That puts fear and discomfort in the students there when somebody hangs up, a rope around the tree. And yet it's in the media. The students are expelled. There seems to be no consequences, psychological consequences, that are applied for men like this. The other issue is...
Well, you know what, Sharon?
Why is he 302'd? Why is that man not being 302'd?
Well,
he sounds like he is... mental illness, again, a double standard.
Well, I hear you, and I appreciate you raise such an important point, and one can certainly hear the hurt in your voice. And I think for you, Dahlia, this, you know, here's a woman, sounds like she's living some of this or has lived some of this, and there are true consequences.
There are, and I think that, you know, again, Sharon gives really resonant and visceral voice to the women's groups in this country who feel that the court failed them. And I would add that, you know, three women justices voted with the Chief Justice in the majority of this case. So, you know, you can't say it was men imposing this on women. This was, you know, seven, eight, depending on how you count it, justices saying that fear that this engendered, you know, while real and while important, is not enough to send someone to jail. And, you know, because they didn't get to this First Amendment question, right, we don't know what the rule is for First Amendment purposes. All we know is that the court said we are looking at a criminal statute and we want to look at, you know, there has to be intent. And the only other thing I would say, I think, is that, you know, what's really, really important going forward is the court needs to take the next case and clarify what the standard is. Because for those of us who wanted the court to make a clear line in the sand and say, this is a threat, this is not a threat, whether it's recklessness or negligence or whatever the standard is, by not giving us that gift, the court has left Sharon and the rest of us to say, I still don't know what the law says.
And Sharon talked about a 302, which I believe is a commitment. And I should just add that it this was November 2010. Alonis's wife, Tara, she did get a protection from abuse order. And then a couple days later, he posts on his Facebook, fold up your protection from abuse order and put it in your pocket. Is it thick enough to stop a bullet?
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, it seems to me that the reason this case has such resonance, and not just, by the way, with women who have suffered from domestic abuse or, you know, the kinds of abuse that Sharon's describing, but any woman who lives on the internet the way you and I do, you know, any woman who has seen what the comments are, you know, this really evokes shades of Gamergate, you know, and other internet scandals where women who get involved in the gaming community, way disproportionately to men, get death threats and rape threats and just unbelievable, virulent, graphic threats. You know, Amanda Hess, one of my colleagues at Slate, wrote about how she went to the police and said, I am getting online death threats on Twitter. And the police, in this case, said, what's Twitter? They just had no idea how to protect her and didn't even understand the world of social media. So this isn't really just about men versus women. This is about the fact that the internet can be an absolute sewer, and it can bring out really the worst in us. But I think, you know, my final sort of coda to Sharon's point is the difference between speech and, you know, just assaulting someone is that speech can hurt, but it's also a core freedom. It's protected by the Constitution. The framers believed that if we couldn't speak, we could never be free.
Sharon, I do appreciate your call. Let me see what Fran from North Philadelphia has to say. Fran, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi,
great
there.
Show.
Thank you.
I guess your guest just made the point that I wanted to make, which is, you know, the courts and the, you know, based on the Constitution, are very reluctant to stop speech that may be horribly threatening and disturbing and traumatizing unless there is a behavior that accompanies it, a conduct that accompanies it. And there's a very, very high constitutional bar that has to be reached to stop that speech, much less throw somebody in jail for it. So I think that there's a little bit, you know, just because it's on the internet does not give it any less protection than if I said it to your face on the street, okay? If I say something to you on the street that's horrible and you perceive as a threat, that's not enough to put me in jail or even sue me. If I say it to you and I punch you, that's a totally different story. And I agree with you politically that it's women that face the majority of this traumatizing, these threats. But I don't know the facts of the Alonis case well enough, but did he even have a gun?
No,
did he
not that stalk, I know.
Did he physically stalk the woman? Did he have any other behavior other than posting online that they could say, okay, we got you? Because it has now crossed the line from speech to behavior.
Fran, you raise some...
To an affirmative act.
Absolutely. No, you raise a lot of really important points. And Dahlia, this is why I guess the First Amendment is so important. And when it's applied to, you know, vile speech, it's complicated, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, this is why, you know, when you look at the sort of rogues gallery of whose names are on, you know, our linchpin First Amendment cases, they're horrible. You know, these are, you know, Larry Flint and the Westboro Baptist Church and Anthony Alonis. These are not people that we admire and adore, but I think the caller makes the point really beautifully and powerfully, which is the alternative, which is putting people in jail for mere words, right, was the kind of thing that made the framers' blood run cold. I mean, that was what they thought. I mean, this is not the First Amendment for, you know, by accident. It's the cornerstone freedom in the Bill of Rights because the framers really believed that if you could be sent to jail because you said words that offended people or angered or enraged people, nobody could be truly free. And I think as a result, we live on this razor's edge in this country where we protect despicable people for saying despicable things because the alternative is so much worse.
I mean, do you think that's what the Supreme Court, the Roberts Court, was also saying?
Well, I think they were saying we just don't want to decide this incredibly thorny question because it raises too many things that we're not yet ready to pronounce about. But I do think that this is very much in the spirit of the same Roberts Court that protected, you remember, grotesque, violent video games, you know, Grand Theft Auto was protected speech, and, you know, these funeral protests were protected speech, the women who went up to women at abortion clinics, even in within these bubbles of safety, and infringed on their ability to access abortion clinics. That was free speech. This is just a court that I think time and time again says speech really, really matters. And each time they say it, they say we hate this speech, but you know it has to mean something that we protect speech in the Constitution.
Unfortunately, I can't take Ben's call, but I'll just read what it says on the screen here. He says, given that social media is a very faceless medium, how can we determine what is a true threat? Is it possible to publish a true threat with a smiley face at the end of it? Sort of, you know, just kidding, right?
Right. Well, and that was, I think, exactly what Abe Ryan was trying to say at the top of the show, that social media has this unique ability to take something that I meant to send to, you know, my dad and my four Facebook followers and throw it out into the world and, you know, to strip it of context and to say, this is what Dahlia was saying. And even when Alonis said, hey, I'm just testing the First Amendment limits, social media has the ability to even strip that out of it. So I think it's a really, really good point. It's one of the things that's profoundly different between the internet and standing on a street and yelling at someone is that you know what happened there. On the internet, you often don't know the whole story.
Do you think, and we're almost out of time here, do you think there will be a case that'll make its way to the court where the court will look at this through a First Amendment lens?
I think they're going to have to, and it may, in fact, be Alonis' own case coming back a second time. But I do think that these issues aren't going away, and I think the kind of urgency and sort of saliency that, you know, even your listeners are expressing, you know, the fact that something's not right in the way we talk to each other will just drive the next case to the court someday.
Well, Dahlia Lithwick, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times and helping us wrestle with this particular issue.
It was a treat to be here, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And she writes about the courts and the law for Slate. And we began the hour with attorney Abe Ryan here in Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page on this particular topic. Sounds like people want to talk, and that's a great thing. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show was produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.